It's an old story you're about to hear. Some of you are acquainted with it. So I would request a couple things. Number one, if you recognize the beginnings of this story and you know the mystery of the card that changed people's hearts, that you not tell anyone nearby, let them guess and try to figure it out as the story develops. Number two, how many of you are parents? And when that little child is born and you look into that little face for the first time, it touches something deep within us. It still does when I think about my two boys. So that's number one, I would say. And number two, I would say about this story is that it's an old story. I don't know. I didn't research really the events that happened in this story when they occurred, but I'm going to guess 60, 80 years ago. How much has changed in the last 20 years with our smartphones and everything else to which we're so accustomed and appreciate? And number two, this story has interwoven in it details about Colorado. It's a Colorado story that takes place almost entirely within our state. And yet it's a story from which I hope we can see Jesus better and that we can get some help on our own spiritual journey. I begin with two paragraphs from our little lady from Desire of Ages, and then we'll get right into the story. Yet into the world where Satan claimed dominion, God permitted his son to come a helpless babe. Subject to the weaknesses of humanity, he permitted him to meet life's peril in common with every human soul, to fight the battle as every child of humanity must fight it, at the risk of failure and eternal loss. I just can hardly comprehend that. Getting some feedback, I don't know where I should stand. The heart of the human father yearns over his son. And does my heart resonate with that? He looks into the face of his little child and trembles at the thought of life's peril. He longs to shield his dear one from Satan's power, to hold him back from temptation and conflict, to meet a bitterer conflict and a more fearful risk. God gave his only begotten son so that the path might be made sure for our little ones. Herein is love. Wonder, O heavens, and be astonished, O earth. John Talbot Waring was having a fitful night's sleep. It was a cold night. The rain seemed incessant with its slow dripping on the eaves. And it was almost time for the third watch of the night. These watches were 4 hours long, and this one was to begin at 2 a.m., the one that he was going to be on. From 2 until 6. And his partner, who was to go out on watch with him, high above Empire, Colorado, above Berthoud Pass, high on the windswept slopes of those meadows and mountains where there was a large flock of cattle. He was roused to wake up and go out and help, because if they were late, the guys that had just put in the 4 hours would be very unhappy if you didn't come relieve them on time. So he stretched a little bit and put on warm clothes, slipped into his boots, and a kind of a sombrero-like hat, and then looked down on his bunk, and there was the yellow slicker lying folded up, which he always used for a pillow. That does not sound like a very comfortable pillow to me, because it would have clammy folds, especially on a cold, dreary night. But he slipped himself into its clammy folds, and he went out to join his partner the third watch of the night, and the guys that they relieved were so thankful. The rain was coming down, drip, 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 but he could tell he'd been up there long enough for 6 months only. He was a city boy from way back east, and he had come out here and endured the hardships of this kind of cowboy's life to immerse himself in meaningless hard labor. He wanted it to be 12 hours a day so he could try to forget the ache and the sorrow and the pain and the disappointments in his own heart. So as they were walking around the cattle, they seemed unusually quiet this night. He recalled how he had come to join this kind of job. I mean, he didn't know how to do this kind of job, but he wanted so much to forget the pain and the stabbing heartache that he endured the ribbing of these cowboys. They would short-sheet his bed, make fun of the way he rode the horse, and after putting up 2 or 3 months of this, he finally earned their respect because he was not a quitter. He would keep after this job. He would go on with it. And he was beating himself up for the 1,000th time that it hadn't worked. He had come out here to forget the pain that he was feeling. And it just seemed like the pain, the ache, the heartache, the separation grew more intense with every day. He wondered if she even thought about him anymore. He wondered if she missed him. And just now, as he was going around the big herd for about the 4th time, he remembered the first time he had seen her standing beside a gorgeous black 8-foot grand piano in the big church where they went together. Her face looked like an angel. The light was just aimed on her face. And her voice sounded even more angelic. Crystal clear, beautiful, dead on pitch, but with perfect interpretation of the song she was singing, and it stole his heart. It's going to happen, Sean. This way. Her angelic demeanor was not just a facade. She was a beautiful creature and a gorgeous girl. And so he began dating her and asking her for dates. And they would go on long walks in the city commons. He recalled the happy times when she would let him hold her hand in the moonlight. And as things developed, they would go to oratorios, concerts, musical events, because she was a musician and he was an amateur musician. John Roski, that was gorgeous. Connie, too. All those little lilts and trills you put in that piano work. He would have appreciated that, and so would she. And Connie appreciates it. He remembered all those things, and then as he's beating himself up about this business of not being able to forget her and the pain in his heart, he remembered the night under the full moon when he proposed to her. And as the story goes, he didn't get down on one knee. He lifted up her angelic face to his and said, "Oh, my darling, you are a great friend, but I want you to be my best friend for the rest of my life. I want you to be the queen of my household and the mother of my children." And in response, she pulled his face toward her and gave him a long kiss that told him what the answer was. And as the kiss was over, she said, "What took you so long?" And he recalled the happy days of their engagement and of their wedding, a beautiful ceremony, and of the honeymoon, and then of setting up housekeeping in their house. It wasn't a huge house, but it had a piano in it. Of the happy days they spent there. And then a cloud came over their relationship and they began to snipe at each other. Our words are so, so important, how we can cut and hurt with just a few short words. Oh, how we need to be careful about that. And it seemed like she was more high-strung and had a quicker temper than he, and she would lash back at him and back and forth. And he was even now kicking himself for having been more patient with her. Why hadn't he? He realized that he had started some of the arguments himself. And then he recalled the scene that was the last straw. How they had been spitting about something at each other, and finally she uttered at the top of her angelic voice, "I wish I had never married you." And that cut him so deeply in the heart that he didn't say anything back. Terrible, horrible hurt down deep in his heart that he just went back into the bedroom, found the largest suitcase they owned, put clothes, shoes, coat, whatever he thought he might need, some underwear and socks, walked out without saying a word to the front door and set down the suitcase and then turned to look at her astonished face. "It has become apparent to me, my darling, that we can no longer live in this house together. I'm leaving and you will never see me again. You can file for divorce for all I care." And with that, he picked up the suitcase and he was gone, hopefully out of her life. And here he was, still thinking of that. What bitterness, what sorrow he had nursed through all these 6 months of trying to forget their life together. And it hadn't worked. And he was beating himself up that it hadn't worked. Why can't I forget? And as he rode around a little more, he noticed that over the eastern ridge of the mountains, it was just beginning to show a little light. And he knew that probably signaled the fact that maybe he only had about another hour of his shift. Then he could go and try to forget as he gulped down some pancakes and syrup in the bunkhouse, in the mess hall. And then he remembered, oh, there was a card in his pocket, in his inside vest pocket. And he took out the card. He could barely see it in the dawning, the early growing morning light, but he already knew what was on that card. It had been addressed to his attorney in Denver. And he, like any of us would, after it had been forwarded to him here up high in the mountains above Empire, Colorado, you would turn it over to see what was written on the backside, just a postcard. There was nothing written there. No picture. But there was communication. Because there scrawled in careful, artistic, flowing lines, 5 lines, 4 spaces, some musical score, 4 bars in the key of G. And he had looked at those notes. He could read notes. And he had begun to hum them even yesterday as the card came. But it was just beyond his, what in the world? Who could have sent this card? He had many friends that were musical. He had no idea where this card came from. And here, as the light began to dawn a little more, he found himself beginning to hum the notes on the card. And then, as is so typical the case for all of us who grow up with favorite hymns that meet needs in our own hearts, when we hear a fragment, a snatch of a melody, if we have sung those and they've become dear to us, we automatically put words to them. And that's what happened to John Talbot Waring as the sun was just beginning to brighten the sky a little more and the rain, the dripping stopped. It was starting to clear. And he startled himself. That's what it meant. I've solved the mystery. I know what this means. And there in the dawning light, he found the stub of a pencil down in his pocket, and he took it out, and using the little flat part of the horn on his saddle, he laid it on there and scribbled and wrote 1 word under each note that he was humming. He was singing. He was now singing the words, and he knew what this thing meant. With that, he noticed that his partner was headed back to the bunkhouse, so he knew the shift was over. He tucked that card back in his vest pocket, and he tore off with that horse faster than that horse had ever been asked to ride. And he galloped up to the bunkhouse, almost stopping so suddenly that the horse landed on its nose. And jumping off, he made a leap over the rail and realized that someone was standing. He was nose to nose with this guy. In his haste, he didn't even see him there. It was his boss, Joe Goberly. "What in the world are you riding up here so fast? You about hurt that horse stopping so fast." "Oh, sir, please. I've got to get to Denver tonight. I've got to get there." "Crazy, man. That's over 100 miles away. How are you going to get there?" "Well, if I can get to Empire before 1 o'clock, the train leaves Empire, headed for Denver, and I can make it. I can make it if you loan me Star." And at this, Joe Goberly, the boss, let out a belly laugh that you could hear clear down to the gates of Denver. "You know I wouldn't lend Star to my best friend, my dearest brother. So what's the use? You aren't going to get Star. But sir, if you lend me Star, I know how he rides, how his tail flies in the air, and we can make it to Empire if you'll just loan me Star." "Guy, it is no use. You're not going to get Star." But sir, end of argument. And then reaching into his pocket, he brought out the card and said, "Sir, would you at least look at this? This is the reason for my haste." And as the old boss, with character-filled lines in his face, he'd been doing this job for a long time. And with a scowl, he looked at this thing. And then he had a change of heart. Around the corners of his mouth began to be a little smile that then blossomed into a full-blown grin. "Why didn't you tell me this in the first place? Of course you can have Star. Hey, guys, go get Star and put my best saddle on it for him. John is riding to Empire." And in just a little while, the hoofbeats were heard as this magnificent stallion, with mane flowing and tail flowing out the back, the clippity-clop. It looked like Star was ready for exercise. It's a good thing, because it was over, it was about 60 miles down to where he could catch the train. Putting the card back in his pocket, grabbing a few other personal items, John Talbot Waring swung easily up, foot in the stirrup, over the saddle, and Star and John were on their way. Amidst the goodbyes, "Have a safe trip," they tore down the trail. And by 8 o'clock, Star had put 20 miles behind them. And in another 15 miles, there was a stage station that John was aware of. And so they made that as they were getting closer and closer to Berthoud Pass. And at the stage station, there was a tank where animals could drink, but it had about an inch of ice on the top. And John Waring took the heel of his boot and cracked through the ice so that Star, who very much deserved a little bit of water, could get a good drink. And then they were off. The road got worse and worse. This is days ago, years ago, before pavement was up there. The road became snow-packed and icy as they approached Berthoud Pass. And John, knowing full well if Star stumbled or got hurt, their trip would be over. So being very wise, within a three-quarter mile of the summit, John dismounted and led Star up the icy trail to the summit of Berthoud Pass. Barb and I have ridden over that pass many times on our way to go ski at Winter Park. We like Winter Park and some other ski areas too. And now, even the road was not sufficiently softer or yielding enough to remount, and so he led Star down a ways further until it seemed like that the snow wasn't quite as crusty, and he mounted up again and hurried on. And as he did so, he could look down, now he's beyond the pass, to the dark line of forest below them, the trees that would define tree line. You know about tree line here in Colorado. So he rode onward toward tree line. A few miles into the trees, which were close on either side of the road, he was surprised first to hear the galloping of another horse coming toward him, and then he could see the rider strange that a horse and rider would be coming up the mountain. He thought it strange. A few miles yet to go, and it was already past noon, according to his pocket watch. He had less than an hour to get down to Empire, probably 45 minutes, and here came this guy who began to look him over in a really strange, evaluative way. Then he noticed something shiny clipped to the guy's jacket on the outside, and upon closer inspection, as he got a little closer, it had 5 points on a star. Not the horse star. As this guy came abreast of John Talbot Waring, riding this magnificent animal that belonged to his boss, the sheriff whipped out his pistol and said, "All right, guy, where do you think you're going with Joe Goberly's horse?" He wouldn't loan that to his mother-in-law. Well, maybe to the mother-in-law. So being very cautious and wary, "You're not going anywhere. I'm going to take you down to Empire, and you're going to be put in jail until they can come claim the horse and you. You say you work for Joe Goberly and he lent you this horse? I don't believe you. You come with me." "But sir, I need to be down there as soon as I can. Maybe you can ride with me, because I've got to catch the 1 o'clock. "Guy, you're going to be behind bars. Forget your trip on that train." And with that, he said, "Well, with the gun still trained on him, would you at least take a look at this card?" And the sheriff was really wary that he might be pulling something else, a weapon, out of his vest. So he looked with a scowl, and when the card came out, then he was puzzled. "What in the world is on this card? This is the reason for my haste, Sheriff. Would you please at least read it?" The sheriff took the card warily, keeping his gun trained on John Talbot Waring, turned it over and began to read. And then his face, too, made this amazing transformation where the corners of his mouth started to go up like this. And he smiled. He says, "Well, if Joe lent you the horse for this errand, I can understand." The card had already changed the hearts of 2 people, and it was to change more before the story is over. "You ride on ahead. You're going to outrun me on Star, but I better be close behind, because when those guys that always come out with curiosity to see the train ride, to see who's going to get on the train and who's going to leave and so on, when they see you on that horse, they're going to want to string you up. So I'm going to have to come down and protect you, but you get on." So galloping away, leaving the sheriff in the dust, hoping he wouldn't be too far behind after that kind of warning, he summited a little rise and looked down on the town of Empire. The train was already at the station. And then it gave those little whistle blows that says, "We're pulling out." And they rung out on the cold, cool air, along with puffs, punctuated black puffs of smoke coming out of the smokestack, as Star and John went like a whirlwind into the town. And sure enough, guys called out, "That's Goberly's horse, that's Star, horse thief, horse thief." And shots, warning shots, rang out on the afternoon air. And it's a good thing the sheriff was right behind. He said, leave him alone. He's just got to catch the train. And now there was a race. A race developed between an iron horse belching black puffy smoke and a real horse whose nostrils were flared and his veins standing out in his neck. As he's breathing that cold air, steam came out of his nostrils. Quite a contrast. As the race was on, John was not giving up yet. He wanted to catch that train in the worst way, and so he spurred Star on. And Star, accepting the challenge, he guided his path parallel to the tracks, and with a clippity-clop, they were off, as the sheriff's explanation seemed to satisfy them. And they all turned to watch this race. "He'll never make it. The train is speeding up." "Oh, he'll make it. Star's good for it." So on and on, the two went until they're 30 feet from the back of the last car, then 20, then 10. "Maybe he's going to make it after all." And Star, giving it his all, his sides heaving, his nostrils flared even more, and the veins standing out even stronger on his neck. 5 feet, 2 feet, 1 feet, as John moved Star up close to the little stairs that come down that last, there on the platform of the last car, and then reaching over and grabbing the railing and making sure he could kick the stirrups away from his feet. He swung up over the railing, and he heard the cheers go up from the crowd at Empire, Colorado, congratulating him on winning the race. And so did the people who were standing on the last platform of the last car. He made it with only a second or two to spare. If the sheriff had interviewed him any longer, if his boss had been a little more reticent, he would not have made it. And there's a race we're in. Have you ever wondered sometimes at security if you're ever going to make the flight on time when they hold you up and there's a big line? But there's a more important meeting for flight through the sky. It'll take 7 days. Do you want to be on board? The Lord himself shall descend from heaven with a shout and the voice of the archangel, the trump of God, the dead in Christ shall rise first. Then we which are alive and remain shall be caught up together with them to meet the Lord in the air. I want to ride that train. I don't want to miss it by even a second. And my dear ones, we can make sure that we don't miss that train if we spend time with Jesus every day and say, Jesus, meet me here in your word. Connie talked about reading through Luke. Doesn't matter what we read. If we invite him to meet us there with his word and with the Holy Spirit to interpret, it can bless our souls and we will develop a relationship so we will never miss that divine appointment. The train is heading toward Denver. It's 44 miles away, according to the Rand McNally distance map thing that I just looked at yesterday. And maybe in those days, I don't know how the train, what tunnels it went through, but it was going to be a long ride, and John Waring, sitting there in the train car, had a sudden realization that all was not well, because he had another train ride clear over to Boston, Massachusetts, and the Zephyr would leave from that Grand Central Station there in downtown Denver. They've remodeled that. Have you seen that? It's kind of a classy old place. And that Zephyr's going to leave, and he won't be able to buy a ticket because he hasn't brought enough cash. He has just a couple, $3 left. And he's got to get some cash, and he felt feverishly, oh, it's there, it's there. His checkbook, at least, was there. So as soon as he can get off of that train, the banks are going to be closed. He doesn't know how he's going to cash this check. But then inspiration comes to him once more. The urgency of the message on the card drives him on with a little ray of hope. He catches a carriage, which nowadays would be a taxi, and says to the driver, take me to the nearest drugstore fast. And I'm going to be making some more stops. Just stay with me and I'll pay you well when this is all over. So take me to the drugstore. And it didn't take very long from that downtown train station for this driver who knew the layout of the city streets to go to the nearest drugstore, because John Waring figured that the pharmacist would probably have a phone. And with a phone in those old days, the crank type, there was maybe even a very thick phone directory for all of Denver, somewhere nearby. And he knew what he wanted to look for. The pharmacist gave him permission to look at the phone book. He turned the pages feverishly over to the yellow pages, to the banking section, and consulting, oh yeah, First National, here's all the officers listed. In those days, they would list the names of things like this. You know, privacy wasn't such a big concern. They would list the names of the bank officials, their addresses, their phone numbers, and he got the one he wanted. Thank you very much. And he was off out to catch the carriage one more time. Take me to this address on 17th Street. Okay, I know where that is. Are you sure that's where you want to? Yes, that's where I want to go. And sure enough, he understood the reason for the carriage driver's question, because they approached a residential area close to downtown Denver where there were palatial homes, palaces almost, mansions. And when they got to the address of the desired location, John Waring looked at himself as he got out of the carriage. Wonder if this guy will even see me. He had on his cowboy attire. You know how quick a rush he had taken off. The old chaps with mud spattered on him. His jeans looked worse. His boots were not very clean. And that sombrero that had been rained on dripped little cold rivulets of water down his back as he was on that morning tour of the cattle. He knew his beard was not very well kept. You think this kind of guy that lives in this house will even talk to me? Well, he should question, because as he went up these steps with brass railings curving up and a huge mahogany door with a brass knocker on there, he was almost afraid to lift the knocker, let it come down 1, 2, 3, 4 times as the sound reverberated back into the mansion. And what seemed like forever, finally a butler came to the door, took one look at John, and almost shut the door in his face. He says, wait, I need to see Mr. Charles Foster.
Do you have an appointment?
No, I just need to see him. It's an urgent matter. And again, looking over him over skeptically, he said,
well, I don't know. I'll check with the boss man. We'll see if he'll see you.
Can't you imagine the conversation that took place between that butler and the owner of the house? There's some old trampy-looking cowboy out here to see you. Will you at least go to the door and say hi to him, see what he wants? Well, we don't know what the conversation was, but soon Mr. Charles Foster, the president of the First National Bank of Denver, came and looked John Talbot Waring in the eye and over his clothing, and he was about ready to shut the door too. But he could tell something about the earnestness in this young man's face, in his eyes, that made him wonder, what in the world? Come on in and stand right here and don't touch anything. Tell me why you need to see me so urgently. And then the story came out. Mr. Foster, I understand you're the president of the First National here in Denver.
That's correct.
And I have an account with the Second National Bank in Boston, which I believe is a sister institution to yours?
Yes, we do business with a Second in Boston.
I know it's after hours, the banks are closed, but I really must catch a train for Boston later this evening, and I need some cash. Can you please help me?
Well, no, I can't help you. I can't even get into the bank right now. Even though I'm president, I don't have an easy way to get in there, and I couldn't get you any money anyway. Everything's locked up.
But, sir, no, I just can't help you. Good day, sir. And then the card. It had changed the hearts of two people already, and he brought the card out, said, sir, would you at least take a look at this? This is the reason for my haste, for my urgency. Please look at it. With slow skepticism, the president of the First National Bank of Denver, Colorado, accepted this grimy-looking card from John Talbot and began to read and look. You say you know where this musical selection came from? Yes, sir. But did you read the words? Yes, I read the words. And I can imagine what's going on in Mr. Foster's brain is, I want to see if this guy really knows what he's talking about. Where is this musical selection taken from? And John was forthcoming with the composer and with the work. You wait right here, and again, don't touch anything. Mr. Foster took the card, went back down a marbled hallway, past tapestries on the wall, turned right into his mahogany paneled library, which had books stacked up in leather bound and gold embossing, as he got a step stool to reach up high on a shelf that he didn't frequent very often, and he pulled down a musical score that was a full 3/4 inches thick, leather bound, gold embossing on the spine, and withdrew that book. Now, I own that same score. I think it's still at home somewhere. But mine is only like half inch thick, and it's paper bound. Much cheaper version, but its music still stirs my heart. And he brought out this volume. He says, now, you say this is from a certain part of this work? And he spread it out on a walnut table, pushing the vase a little to the side, and held the card up as John Talbot Waring helped him turn to the correct page, to the correct chorus, and to see those words written there with the notes. Mr. Foster, with skepticism, compared card to note and note to card on that beautiful score. And then the same thing happened to his heart. And the same little smile began to come up on that old financial rich guy that lived in a mansion as he smiled from ear to ear. Well, this changes everything. And you say your name is Waring? Yes, sir. I have decided to help you after all. I see why you are so intent in your urgency to want to go far to the east tonight. But I can't get you any money from a bank. So here's what we're going to do. Let me see your checkbook. Let's see my checkbook. Why do you want to look? And as the president of the First National looked at the checkbook and saw that it was indeed from the Second National Bank in Boston, and that the checkbook looked well used and that it was authentic. You need a little more checking than that nowadays for scammers. But it satisfied Mr. Foster. So he says, here's what we're going to do. We're going to exchange some checks. You write me a check and I'll write you my personal check back. And you can take it to the Brown Palace Hotel. And I am a personal friend of the evening clerk there. And when he sees my signature, he will give you the money. How much do you think you'll need? And John, doing a little calculation, was thinking, maybe I could get by on $100. No, I don't think so. And now John's heart fell to his feet. Is he reneging on the deal? Is he not going to even give me anything? When he said, no, I don't think so. And then with another little twinkle in his eye, Mr. Foster said, you better make it 200 unless you want to appear on the West Coast dressed as you are. So a $200 valued checks were interchanged between Charles Foster and John Talbot Waring in the mansion on 17th Avenue in downtown Denver. And as with profuse thanks, he shook Mr. Foster's hand, noticed outside as he tore down the steps to the carriage that the carriage driver had done what he requested. Stay there until my errands are done. And he hopped in that carriage and says, to the Brown Palace now. And it didn't take them long to go to the Brown Palace Hotel. There's an old urban legend that says the unsinkable Molly Brown, a survivor on the Titanic, had some connection with that Brown Palace Hotel. I just checked it online, said that's a myth. It was a whole different Brown family, but she did stay there after she was rescued from the Titanic. And so did the Beatles. Anyway, I checked how much it costs a night nowadays. During the kind of off-season, it's $129 a night if you want to go stay at the Brown Palace. So now they're roaring over there to the Brown Palace Hotel. I don't know if I'll need you anymore, sir, but if you'll wait till I get some cash in here, I'll pay you. And so he went to the night clerk, showed the night clerk a $200 check from Charles Foster, president of the First National Bank, and the And the night clerk's eyes in recognition and a smile said, certainly, sir, how would you like that? In other words, what denominations do you want? And with the $200 in his hand, he paid the driver. And then the next thing he did was go to the telegraph office located in that hotel. Nowadays, we wouldn't know what a telegraph office would be good for, hardly. All the smartphones, a little text would be sent and we'd be done. But he went to the telegraph office and told the telegraph operator the address to which this was to be delivered and what message it should say. Postcard received. Understood. be on the Zephyr tonight for Boston. Arrive tomorrow morning early. See Luke 1:13. I see some of you turning for your butt. That's okay. And with that, with the dots and dashes, the clicks of a skilled telegraph operator, flying across the silver wires 2,000 miles away to find an operator there who could decipher the Morse code and translate it back to good old English and then send it on its way. The next thing that John Waring did, realizing how he must still appear and how Mr. Foster had said if he wanted to change of clothes, he asked the night clerk, is there any chance, any hope, that you could convince those clerks that open up the gift shop and the apparel store that they could help me get a suit? And in less time than it takes to tell, the power of Charles Foster's name on the check meant there was some importance here. And so they opened it up, and John Waring was able to buy a whole new suit of clothes with new shoes, a shirt, a tie, the whole works. And he thanked them all profusely and tipped them some. The carriage driver had long departed, but John knew that it wasn't a very big walk from the Brown Palace over to the train station where he bought his ticket. He bought the ticket. The card had changed the hearts of three people so far, but if you analyze it a little more deeply, it really had changed four. First, Joe Goberly, then the sheriff, then Mr. Foster, the president of the bank. But it had done amazing work deep into the psyche and the soul of John Talbot Waring himself. It had changed four hearts so far. And as John boarded that train on time with a ticket one way to Boston, Massachusetts, he sat there in that plush seat of the train thinking over the history that lay behind this car. And of the ache in his heart that had turned to joy. And he began humming those four bars on that card, and then not giving an absolute care of who would hear him, he began singing the words on that card, softly at first and then louder and louder, till finally it was going out the top of his lungs, like it did for me on September 7th. 1968. I had been in labor all Friday evening as my wife labored along to bear our firstborn son, and it was an all-night affair. And when little Tad was born, the fall after you graduated in the spring, Connie, in 1968 from Platte Valley, I was teaching. As little Tad was born and brought to us then, and when I looked in the face of that little child, it did something deep in my father's heart, and I'm sure it did to Barb. We began to check each little hand and each little foot. Are there for sure five digits on this little hand, and five little fingers on this, and five little toes there, and five little toes there? And does he look like he's alert? Does he look like he's retarded? He seemed to be okay. And we offered our own prayers of thanksgiving. And as little Tad was brought to put, to be laid on his mother's chest, he had done some crying like newborns do. His little lungs filled with air that he'd never breathed before. And the cold outside, he'd been used to the warmth inside that mommy's tummy. And now as they laid him on her breast, I can only imagine that with his little head next to her chest, he could hear the familiar beats of the heart that he'd grown up with for many months. And that seemed to put him to sleep. He lay there asleep on Barbie's chest. And after a sufficient appropriate time, I asked her permission, the queen of the house, if I could leave and get some sleep. And so I got in my car and I tore off the 23 miles from Grand Island, Nebraska back to Shelton, to the academy, to the old farmhouse that they didn't want anymore. They had moved it a mile to the east because it was a site. They didn't want anything to do with it, but they let teachers live in it. We lived in that house for 10 years, and it was put together with square nails. The nails in all the 2x4s and joists were with square nails. And I tore into that house. I went to my record collection, you know, the 12-inch LPs. I extracted the correct record and put it on a turntable. That's how we played them in those days. And I looked at the record jacket. Oh, yeah, this is going to be track number so-and-so. And dropped the needle on that track and turned the volume up higher than it had ever been turned in that house and shook the rafters till it was almost ready to shake the square nails out of the boards. And my heart swelled, and I sang the words that John Talbot was singing on board that train. For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, unto us a son is given, for unto us a child is born. And I sang that over and over. My heart would burst. And John Waring didn't care if anybody else looked at him strange, because he was going home to meet his son and to see his angelic wife once again. She had sent that card to him. 2,000 miles, a pale young wife lay on her bed with a little bundle beside her. And on the bed beside her was her Bible opened to Luke 1:13, where it said, "Thou shalt call his name John." That's wonderful. It's wonderful that my son was born and my other son was born. All these children that we love and cherish. But it is 10,000 times a millionth power more wonderful that Jesus came and was born. And that's what that chorus from the Messiah is all about. For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given. That is referring to our Lord and Savior, our Jesus Christ, who came to make it safe for our little ones, to make it safe for us to meet the heavenly train that's going to depart. And we're going to turn and sing our closing song in just a moment, but I want to talk to you about it just a little bit. You can turn to hymn number 140 and just look at that a little bit, because I want to ask you some questions. As Ron Lindsay read Luke 2:7-14, Luke 2:7 is key to this song. She brought forth her firstborn son, wrapped him in a manger, swaddling clothes, laid him in a manger because there was no room for him in the inn. My key question to you, my dear ones, this day, is there room in your heart for Jesus? And if there is, are you willing to make more room for him, to enlarge the space by spending more time? And if the cares of this world have begun to crowd that room a little smaller, and you'd like to say to Jesus this morning, "I want to make my heart bigger for you," before the music even starts, and it'll start in just a moment. Whoever's going to play that, you can be ready to go here. Before the music starts, if you'd like to say to Jesus in the heavenly family, "I want to make more room for you in my heart. I want to make room, abundant room for you." Just think about that. And then as we sing those words, "There's room in my heart for you," that's the ending of our closing song. Make it meaningful. Study those words as we sing together. But if you want to say to Jesus right now, "I want to make room for you in my heart, more room perhaps than I've made before," just think about it and stand quietly before we sing. Stand right now if you want to say to Jesus, "I want to make more room for you in my heart."